Okay, so Steve, we're here for a second series of Not Enough Champagne.
I know, it's a miracle.
The difficult second season, as I believe they always call it.
Yeah. Sophomore album.
Absolutely. We've stocked up on tinned food in case President Trump wins during the second season.
Yeah, we've got Sainsbury's beans rather than Heinz, but other than that, I think we're good.
And I've just locked the back door. There's no way we can avoid Brexit by the back door, as Theresa May is so worried about.
Yeah, it's good. It's locked and everything, so no worries there.
And this second series is all about taking back control, because now it turns out, Steve, that despite the fact that 3 months ago we voted to leave the EU, the UK isn't a democratic paradise. It turns out that leaving the EU might not solve all of our problems.
I'm shocked by this news. Truly, I am.
So we're going to begin this series all about taking back control. We're going to be talking about taking back control over the Labour Party. We're hours after Jeremy Corbyn beat Owen Smith with 61.8% of the vote. And we're going to start by asking the question, would Jeremy Corbyn have defeated God in the Labour leadership race? So the reason why I think Jeremy Corbyn would probably have defeated God if God had been able to run in the Labour leadership race is because if you look at the YouGov poll that was done, there was only one poll that was done of Labour, the Labour electorate during the campaign by YouGov.
Which was spot on, by the way.
But they, of the people who were going to vote for Corbyn, 94% thought that Corbyn was doing well as Labour leader. 97% said he was principled. 93% said he was honest. 75% said he was courageous, 64% said he was strong, and 56% said he was likely to lead Labour into an election.
Can I just put a huge shout out to the 6% of people who said they were going to vote for Corbyn and didn't think he was doing a good job?
Well, it's like those people you see on polls who, you know, the 1 or 2% that think that Ed Miliband is really right-wing or that Nigel Farage is really left-wing. And you want to meet these people and say, why do you think Nigel Farage is a massive socialist? But with those figures, God could have stood. Jesus himself could have come down from the clouds and stood against Corbyn, and Corbyn would still have beaten him, wouldn't he?
That's not really that much of a surprise. The liberal intelligentsia that make up the middle class left are mainly atheists these days, so they probably just deny that God was actually standing and then all vote for Corbyn because he was the only candidate.
Of course, the problem is that Corbyn wasn't standing against God. He was standing against Owen Smith,
who's much less impressive.
Well, Owen Smith is definitely not God. In fact, let's go back to happier times 2.5 months ago, to what we said about Owen Smith when he was first standing. But I mean, what seems to be happening is Angela Eagle is preparing a leadership bid, apparently forestalled on Friday, not just because of the Boris stuff, but also because of Owen Smith, who neither of us have heard of.
No, I can hand on heart say that I've been heavily involved in politics since I was 16. I eat, breathe and sleep politics. I have never come across Owen Smith before up until this moment, and neither have you. And it's like, where has this guy come from?
It's like the moment in the thick of it where Claire Ballantyne's advocated as Prime Minister and the night editor of the Daily Mail says, I literally have no idea who she is. So what have we learnt about Owen Smith since then?
Well, leadership campaigns are more often than not a way for a politician to try and define themselves. And the message that Owen Smith was trying to put out, seemingly, was, look at me, I'm just as left-wing as Jeremy Corbyn, but more competent. Which you can see the logic behind it. If the core case against Jeremy Corbyn is that he's incompetent, which, generally speaking, that's what an awful lot of Labour MPs are concerned with, then, you know, it makes sense to try and latch on to the similar kind of policies so that you can appeal to the same people that were attracted to Jeremy Corbyn, and then you can deal with the core complaint of incompetence, and you can just say, look, I'm better all around. I agree with the same things, but I'm just going to be better at the job. So you can see the logic. Unfortunately, Owen Smith is not better at the job. In fact, his entire leadership campaign was filled with gaffes of various sorts. So he said he wanted to smash Theresa May back onto her kitten heels, which elicited complaints about that he was kind of talking, alluding to violence against women.
Perhaps one reason why women prefer Corbyn to Smith by about 2/3 to 1/3.
Potentially. So you've got that gaffe. There was a time he kind of implied he had a 29-inch penis during a Q&A session of some sort. I can't remember the exact context, but he was joking about the inside of his inside leg size, but kind of talked about it in a way where it was just like, yeah, I've got a 29-inch dick, mate. So it's
A bit like how he said he was a winner because he'd fought off thousands of men to marry his wife.
Yeah. Bear in mind, 2.5 months ago, we'd never heard of this guy, and we're able to now list off a whole host of gaffes just off of the top of our head. That kind of gives you an idea about the kind of the competence level we're dealing with for him.
The word I could use to best describe Owen Smith's campaign, I think, is spunky in maybe all versions of the word. But it reminded me of a football team who are kind of 3 or 4 nil down, who then start rallying and score a couple of consolation goals. So, you know, you might lose 4-2 or 3-1 or something,
but you took the fight to them.
In any of the hustings meetings, Smith was being jeered by Labour members, having to put up with the same lie from Corbyn, his supporters, all the time, that Labour were ahead in the polls before the coup, which is just demonstrably not
there
true.
There was one poll.
One poll in a year in which Labour have been ahead.
Yeah, I think the term I would use to describe Owen Smith is actually banter. I mean, when he answered the fabled Mumsnet question about what's your favourite biscuit, he kind of goes, it's a Garibaldi, because you've got to love a biscuit named after a revolutionary. And it's just like, that is the kind of joke that gets made by someone who's a hell of a lot less funny than they think they are. Granted, it was still a better response than Corbyn's, I am anti-sugar, but I would go for a shortbread bread. Owen Smith is the sort of person who probably thinks he's still down with the kids in that kind of way. He still thinks he's actually got knowledge. He'll come out, if he were leader, and say, yeah, my favourite band is insert whatever the biggest band in the charts is at the moment. With Gordon Brown, it was the Arctic Monkeys.
Whereas Jeremy Corbyn's is obviously UB40.
Yeah.
Leading to
One version of UB40. The actual version of UB40 with the good members doesn't like him.
Well, this is the thing where there was a wonderful Chris Brooke tweet during the campaign, and Chris Brooke is an Oxford academic, I believe, who said that I'm going to stop thinking of the Corbyn media operation as politics and start thinking of it as performance art. And I can't really think of a better illustration of that than using a band from the 80s who no one's ever heard of, which is a great metaphor for Corbyn anyway, but using one which has split irrevocably and can only talk through their lawyers. I feel bad having a lot of hate for Owen Smith, Bantasaurus Rex, as you've said.
Yeah.
But he was obviously quite articulate. Maybe no one could have won at this point, which is maybe why you end up with a leadership candidate who no one has heard of. Do you think that maybe it would have been different if a Dan Jarvis had run, if a Chukwuemeka had won?
I'm not entirely sure. I think at this point, whoever had run for the leadership would have lost. I think it's a bit up in the air to say that Angela Eagle, for instance, would have done better. I think she'd have made less gaffes. Which I think would have potentially meant that the membership vote might have been a bit more Smith's way. Plus, there's the argument about, hey, we can actually have a female leader. I think she's LGBT as well. I think she's a lesbian.
Yeah.
So you can say, so we've got two firsts in one there, which, you know, symbology matters in this sort of thing. Which, you know, as shallow as it might seem, that can and does appeal to people.
But Owen Smith's a normal bloke, he said to himself. He's got a wife.
And he
literally had to fight her out of the hands of the claws of
40,000 other Welshmen, yes. I mean,
that's how they choose spouses in Wales.
That's kind of the problem, I think, actually, is that Owen Smith is just another bloke. He is just another white guy in a suit. So maybe Angela Eagle would have done better. I reckon Angela Eagle may have been able to get that extra 2 or 3% to push them over the top to the 40% mark, which I think in terms of kind of morale for moderates would have been enough to kind of make them go, yes, this is worth fighting for. I think failing to hit that mark, which is like the Smith campaign themselves said that we don't think we're going to win, that 40% is the benchmark, which they failed to reach. I think Eagle would have hit that, potentially. I think someone like Chuka Umunna, whilst you can make the argument, yes, we're putting forward the first ethnic minority leader for the Labour Party, and therefore arguably the first potential ethnic minority Prime Minister, the reality is he's too Blairite, he would have gotten just swiped out of the water. And from my personal perspective, I think a lot of talk about him is overblown. And then again, and then you end up with your Dan Jarvis types, who, let's be honest, it's the same problem. There's nothing overly interesting there. In any other circumstance, yeah, Dan Jarvis would win, simply because he's able to appeal to like that kind of middle England. I was fighting for Britain, and I'm fighting for the working people of Britain. That, you know, from a marketing perspective, it writes itself for someone like him. Which is why I think, actually, in terms of moving forward with Labour, what they need to try and do is get some... and this is already starting to be talked up about. They need to almost drop the notion of getting a moderate for the time being, and just accept it's going to be somebody from the left, and it's going to be somebody who's currently been loyal. And that person is probably going to be Clive Lewis, who is their current Shadow Defence Secretary. He's probably doing a couple of other jobs as well, because, you know, they all need to. It's the only way they can make up the numbers at the moment. But Clive Lewis is a former army man himself. He's very much on the kind of the left of the party. He's been loyal to Corbyn, and from the looks of things, seems to be a bit more competent than Corbyn. He certainly doesn't have all of the baggage attached with Corbyn and McDonnell and those sorts of people. So, if you're the Labour Party, what you probably want to be looking to do is you just sit down and you talk to him and go, "We're going to back you. Every last one of us is going to back you. We believe that you probably can potentially reach out to the middle classes, because you can do that. I fought for Britain, and now I'm fighting for Britain's working families." That, as a notion, should go down quite well. We can finesse policy at a later date, but that's what...
Labour's been doing that for about... You know, actually, even when they're in government.
Yeah. Especially in the Brown.
Oh, yeah. It's been about 10 years.
but you can take someone like Clive Lewis, who is, in many ways, a blank slate, and push him. So, for the Labour moderates, that's what they need to do, is push like someone like Clive Lewis. To a lesser extent, Lisa Nandy would also work, I think. If Momentum and McDonnell and those sorts of people want to be sensible, what they should do is also get behind Clive Lewis. They should persuade Corbyn and McDonnell to just step back and say, "We'll give you some nice cushy gig. You'll be in charge of something or other. Jeremy, you can be president of the Labour Party and travel, doing the exact same things you're doing now, traveling around, rallying the troops. No issues, no problem. We'll even give you a nice little pay packet for it. And your job is basically just to attend rallies and make people feel good about themselves."
Isn't that the problem with what you're suggesting? Is that I think a version of that has probably already been suggested when Tom Watson was trying to broker a compromise during the failed attempted putsch
Labour MPs. I'm talking about what should happen in order to try and make an outcome that works and actually would restore proper normal politics in Britain and have a functioning Labour Party. That doesn't mean it will happen, and I strongly suspect it won't, because I think Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell's egos have just grown and ballooned to the size of, like, Paris.
Well, I think that is why the Corbyn story is very fascinating, because he's someone who has been an obscure backbencher for 30 years, didn't want to stand, but it was his turn because McDonnell had done it, Diane Abbott had done it. And now that he's won quite spectacularly last year, I think you can tell that his ego has grown. You could tell over the campaign with Smith, when it was more and more obvious that Corbyn was going to win, partly because the Smith campaign was a bit sclerotic, starts off with him basically having the same policies as Corbyn, ends with him trying to attack Momentum and saying they're the same as Militant, which they're not.
They're not.
I'm not going to digress into Labour in the 80s, because no one wants to hear that. But then Momentum is not a Trotskyist party within the Labour Party with its own candidates. And you can tell he was getting more and more smug and more confident in victory.
Yeah, I mean, and to be honest, can you blame him for actually his ego growing a little bit? When you are turning up to talk to people, and there are hundreds, and in a couple of cases, thousands of people standing out there chanting your name, waving signs, and treating you like the Messiah, it is going to go to your head. And it's one of those things. There was an article I was reading about US presidential candidates that lose, and the kind of the adjustment that they go through. It's like, because they're surrounded by people who are building them up, trying to keep them confident. When they eventually lose, it comes as a complete shock to them. Because even though they've probably seen all of the polls and things like that, polls are abstract. They're things you look at where for people to analyse. When you're stood in front
of... And they're all manipulated by the right-wing press as well.
But when you're stood in front of people who are into you and cheering you and are kind of clearly on your side, and there's thousands, if there's hundreds of thousands of them that you're seeing day in, day out across a country, you're going to get think that you're going to be able to do it, because you're seeing it with your own eyes. And the real that you experience is stronger than the abstract.
Mm.
And I think that's kind of the sort of thing which has happened with Corbyn, is that he probably at this point maybe does actually think he could win an election, because all he's seeing is all of these people kind of coming up to him. Because
I think the thing is, as you say, it's what happens now and how Labour tries to unite. And it has to be with Corbyn as leader. It's all right talking about people like Clive Lewis, but that's a few years down the road.
Next summer. After all, Corbyn did say he was in favour of annual leadership elections.
I think...
12 months, Corey. 12 months and we get to go through it all again.
In 6 years since 2010, Labour spent 9 months having leadership contests. Basically, navel-gazing. The first one after 2010 was bad enough, because in that time, in the space that was left, the coalition government set the narrative about economic mess that Labour left us in, overspending, mm-hmm. which Labour still haven't really combated.
Nope.
In that kind of post-Brexit government, completely all over the place on Brexit, all over the place on grammar schools, and still the narrative is about Labour disunity. There's a lot of friends of mine who I think are quite soft Corbynites. They're not part of the cult who think that he's virtuous and brilliant in every way, but they think he's quite a decent leader and needs a bit more time to prove himself, and now isn't the time to get rid of him because he's not had long enough. And I think the analogy I would say it's like if you're a sniper with a gun, you have one bullet in your chamber. There was one opportunity that Labour MPs had to try and get rid of Corbyn,
and it was probably next summer rather than this one.
This wasn't the time. And I think if it happens again in a year, they're going to look ridiculous, because then Corbyn and his and Momentum will say, now you are destabilising the party, and they would be right. You even had Owen Smith at the end of the leadership campaign saying, actually, I think Corbyn should have been given a bit more time. And when you have that, then you kind of know you've lost the argument.
Yeah.
And it's about what happens to the party now. And I think actually when we're talking about taking back control, what I think it's going to be about now is a bit like it was in the early 80s. You're going to have a lot of very dry, very constitutional discussions about how are we going to make up shadow cabinet elections? Are we going to have just MPs doing it? Are we going to have electoral colleges voting for them? That might be a way of getting some Labour MPs back you might not get otherwise. Are we going to change how we make party policy? There's going to be a lot of arguments that we had 30, 35 years ago that are going to be rehashed, because people like John Landsman, who were part of the campaign for Labour Party democracy in the early 80s, they're running Momentum now. They're going to push the same arguments about reselection of MPs. Are we going to have mandatory reselection? And we're going to have those arguments all over again. And I think that's what you're going to see over the next couple of years. I think Corbyn will talk about unity, but he's also going to talk about wanting to involve the mass membership in the party. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but if we're going to end up talking about Labour's making policy or Labour's choosing the shadow cabinet, I think then you are going to end up with a bit of a conflict. And I think...
Yeah, and I think the issue is that there's just so many little niggly details around all that sort of stuff, which is going to take up a lot of time and effort of the Labour Party and the Labour leadership, which means the job of actually being in the opposition will fall behind. Just for instance, as an example, we're talking about the shadow cabinet elections there. They're probably going to be brought back. Should it just be MPs who vote for it? Should the wider membership have a say? And if the wider membership have a say, what are we defining as the membership? Do supporters get a say? Or do you have to pay the card? pay to have the membership card. That there, three different outcomes, varying degrees of kind of positivity for Corbyn in all of them. Like, one which doesn't necessarily work for him very well, PLP get the final say on who's in the shadow cabinet. McDonnell leaves. Lewis is probably not there anymore. Clearly not feasible and not acceptable to Corbyn and the leadership. Midway point, okay, that kind of works. Maybe McDonnell manages to squeak in there, but he loses Diane Abbott almost certainly, because look at the figures. The membership, broadly speaking, significant portions of it did not vote for Corbyn this time round. In fact, membership pre-2015 members were something like 68% for Smith. So you have a split there, which means the only way Corbyn can guarantee that he's going to be able to kind of get people that he wants in his shadow cabinet, or rather not lose key allies like John McDonnell, is to push it out to the wider registered supporters as well. At that point, it becomes completely unacceptable to the PLP, and you're back at square one. And because the compromise solution of those three things, of giving members a say, still doesn't give Corbyn a boost. It doesn't give him the authority that he wants. Because this is the key thing here. Those registered supporters are the people, in many ways, who have changed the dynamic of the Labour Party. Yes, more people have joined who are of more kind of Corbynite persuasion, since Corbyn's been leader and in the run-up to him becoming leader. But those registered supporters have kind of broken for Corbyn more significantly than anybody else both times.
They were 70-30 in this vote,
yeah,
apparently.
So they've completely changed the dynamic, but they're not even members.
One of the things that was battled furiously by the left and the right in the early 80s was how you elect the leader. And it used to be, in the early 80s, it was the PLP would choose a Labour leader. And the left changed this to be an electoral college system. It was the right in the 80s who were proposing one man, one vote, which is what was brought in by Ed Miliband.
Well, it was a way to try and decrease the perception of union influence.
Mm. And the way it was done, where you could just have, you could pay £3 and have a vote, that maybe seemed like a good idea, and you open it up like the French socialists have done, where they have 1 or 2 million people voting in a primary, and they completely either ignored or didn't think that you would get thousands and thousands of people lining up to vote for the far left candidate. It was a perfect storm in a lot of ways. Not helped by the fact that you had MPs nominating Corbyn a year ago who didn't think he was up for the job, so that you still had the PLP still had the nominating process as their kind of bulwark against an extremist candidate,
and yet they threw it away because they wanted to
broaden the debate.
Yeah, Sadiq Khan, to be honest, is probably one of the best examples of this. Probably by this point knew he was going to be going for the Mayor of London, win as
David
well.
Lammy was nominated for a similar reason.
Yeah. Desperately trying to kind of court a certain section of the party and the notion of that they, so that they can get those votes for a later thing, entirely self-serving, nominated someone that they don't think is fit for the office.
Like the members who are voting for Corbyn is quite interesting. As you say, a lot of the older standing Labour members are quite pro-Smith or... but I think with Corbyn, you've got a mixture of the people like John Lansman, so the people who were on the left in the 80s and haven't changed their views in 30 years, a bit like Corbyn. But you've also got the younger, more left-wing...
Now, this is something that's I was looking at some stats on this earlier today. Obviously, as the election results for the leadership have come in, various different kind of figures have kind of trickled in as well. Now, I think this comes from the YouGov polling, which was pretty damn accurate.
Mm-hmm.
To a certain extent, we're dealing with subsamples here, so it's not necessarily ideal or 100% accurate.
Mm-hmm.
But Smith did better amongst 18 to 24-year-olds than Corbyn did. So the notion that it's like young, idealistic people coming in and driving Corbyn to victory, it's not... I say it's not young people, it's like it's people of our kind of age, like late 20s to early 30s and 40s, who have either been put off Labour because they went too right wing, or they've just become interested in it and have always been that kind of left wing type thing and come into it. That's just now. But the notion that it's like young people doesn't seem to be actually borne out, and especially when you look at a number of the crowds at the rallies, they're not inherently younger than a lot of political rallies or the people that turn up at them. It's a good mix. So fair play to Corbyn for bringing in. But what they've managed to do very well, so they can do media management when they want to, is whenever there's a freaking photo of Corbyn out there campaigning, he's surrounded by a group of young people. So he looks more dynamic. He looks like he's got those people on his side. And we've just kind of bought into that narrative. But the bits of data we have to support that don't. We need to be very careful when we're talking about this sort of stuff. It's not actually necessarily young people who are driving this. I suspect actually it is more the kind of the middle-aged, more secure people who can afford. Like if there's a Tory government, then this Tory government and the next Tory government, they're not likely to be affected by it. John Landsman lives in a fucking fancy apartment in the middle of Mayfair or somewhere like that. It's worth millions.
Nothing's too good for the workers, Steve.
Exactly. He's not going to be affected by anything. And this is the thing, and this is what really annoys me about a lot of the Corbynites and the Corbynistas, is that so many of them are very secure. They are so very, very privileged in many, many ways that they don't realise that their experience of being privileged doesn't continue into other people, and that there are actual effects of them taking these positions which will have effects on other people. Because at the end of the day, you know, if the 15-20 years of in effect Tory government, and I include the Tory-led coalition in this as well, despite being a coalition supporter, sets a sort of kind of plan in action.
Well, people don't want Labour to be anti-austerity. People want Labour to have answers on welfare. They want Labour to have answers on immigration. They want Labour to have answers on entrepreneurialism and getting people jobs and supporting businesses.
Yeah. And they're nowhere near for a number of this. Owen Jones, who despite voting Corbyn again for this election...
He voted Corbyn again?
Yeah, he voted Corbyn again, I know. You know that 6% we were joking about earlier who didn't think he was up for leadership but was still voting for
Owen
him?
Jones is the
Owen 6%. Jones is the 6%.
We should have that on the T-shirt.
But yeah, Owen Jones wrote a quite a good piece, actually, which is kind of outlining all of the different things that he thinks Labour needs to look to do. And one of the things he said was, let's deal with the fact that the job market's changed and actually address the self-employed and come up with some policies which work for them. And he was attacked for it. Like, people actually came up, were attacking him on Twitter, and in effect calling him a Tory, because he wanted to kind of come up with policy proposals which helped a significant portion of the British working class. Because, you know, your brickies, your plumbers, your painters, your decorators, the kind of traditional skills and trades which are the bread and butter of what the labour movement should be about, they don't work for a single company, a lot of them. They are self-employed.
We should nationalise them.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the only way.
Clearly. But they are self-employed, and you do need to get to grips with that sort of stuff.
I don't think there's going to be a split. Not yet, anyway, with Labour MPs and Corbyn. It's too risky. We've got the lesson of the SDP in the 80s. It doesn't end well. Especially under our rubbish voting system, it's just not going to happen, I don't think. You're going to have a few people like Yvette Cooper and Chuka Amana who are applying for select committees, so either the new Brexit select committee. Do you think he'll be able to fill a shadow cabinet when he appoints one next week? Will enough people return to the fold?
I don't know, to be quite honest. I think a serious kind of test will be, does he actually offer Owen Smith anything? If Smith isn't in that shadow cabinet,
I think then... Smith has said he won't serve, though. I think I'm right in saying that, because I think Smith said he would offer Corbyn the post of president in the way you suggested earlier. I think Smith has said...
Doesn't matter if Smith serves, Corbyn needs to make the offer. Because if he doesn't make that offer, it looks like he's trying to cut out Smith. And yes, while Smith wasn't the ideal person, by all accounts, he was actually all right as shadow working DW.
He had some decent achievements. They can make him minister for tailoring, maybe, and measure people's inside leg measurements.
Yeah, or something.
We're going to be talking about who voted for Brexit next week and what strategies the Labour Party could use to win over those voters.
If you enjoyed listening to this episode of Not Enough Champagne, then please make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or wherever it is that you get your podcast from. If you are on iTunes, then please leave us a review. And rate us. The more people that review and rate us, the more people will find it, and the more listeners we'll get. So thanks in advance, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Paperback Rioter. Steve is at Centre Radical. Goodbye.
Goodbye.